Chapter 2. Arnest.
In the drawing room of the rectory, Cale studied the old priest before him. Brother Jorski was nearly 70, he guessed. Jorski's hands shook as he spoke, his eyes shifting nervously from Cale to Dennis, then Legrand. He looked like a man at the end of his tether.
"It's a godsend that you brothers are here," Jorski said at last.
"We're glad to be of service, Monsignor," Legrand replied while sniffing the brandy that Jorski had poured for him.
Legrand seemed at home in the cozy drawing room, drinks, a crackling fire. The only thing missing were a few beautiful women, who always fell under his spell. Cale sat near the fireplace, across from Jorski, and his eye was drawn to a remarkable silver plate upon the mantel. Engraved on it were the 40 martyrs, standing hand in hand upon the frozen shore of Sebaste, their countenance stern, their destiny sealed.
"Calm yourself, Brother Jorski," Dennis said, stoking the fire. "You're with friends now."
"Yes, thank you, brother," Jorski said. "I should begin by telling you that the Lady Gravis is a great patron of our church and spends countless hours in parish service. But last month brought her a terrible shock indeed. It was a devastating blow to us all when her daughter Eleanor was brutally murdered. Two schoolboys found her face down in a culvert just south of Landern Hill. It was strange to find her there, for Eleanor had been bedridden for several weeks with fever. When Dr. Huber brought Eleanor to the rectory, I could see that her throat had been ripped out, as if by a wild animal. Local hunters searched the forest for signs of a wolf, without success. I buried Eleanor the next day. Nothing, my brothers, is as sorrowful as burying the young. And the poor lady already a widow and now this. As I mentioned in my letter, it was 3 nights later when Lady Gravis reported the first visitation. I must admit that I lack experience in
dealing with a Nosferatu," Legrand said, pulling Jorski's letter out of his pocket. Jorski glanced at Legrand and shifted in his chair, as if expecting sarcasm or rebuke. Legrand smiled kindly instead, nodding for him to continue.
"I refused to believe it at first," Jorski said. "The Lady Gravis begged me to stay at her estate for the next few nights, and I felt obligated to do so, if only to reassure her. It was on the second night when the lady roused me from my sleep and whispered in my ear.
'She walks in the garden, Father. Eleanor has come home.'
Suspecting that someone was playing a cruel hoax on the lady, I snatched my walking stick and ran down the hallway, throwing open the front doors," Jorski added. "The night was moonlit, so it wasn't difficult to see, but as I came to the side of the garden wall outside the lady's bedroom, I saw nothing. I slowly retraced my steps, my rage turning to confusion. Then my senses sharpened, and my soul screamed with alarm. By some intuition though, it was more like instinct. I knew that I was being stalked in the darkness. And I knew, my brothers, without even turning around, that she was there. She stood perfectly still, as if studying me. Her white burial gown shimmered in the moonlight, and I stepped back, putting space between us. Then she grinned, and I saw that she was no longer human. As I reached for my crucifix, she laughed with a high, quivering bark. That sound, it was not of this earth. Yet despite my terror, a part of me wanted to submit, to surrender to this creature. This demoness exuded an evil so pure, so malevolent, that I stood torn between desire and repulsion. It was the stable hand Victor who saved me. He ran to my side with a torch in hand, and this creature, I dare not call it Eleanor, fled into the woods, and Victor gave chase till I called him back. The next morning I confided all to my colleague, Brother Munt, and told him of my intention to contact our bishop. Munt warned against it, arguing that it was probably a gypsy girl coming out of the woods to steal under the cover of darkness. However, there was no uncertainty in my mind as to the nature of this spirit, which I explained in a letter to His Eminence. Last week I received a reply from the diocese stating that you were coming to question me, and that I was to remain silent on the issue until your arrival." Jorski lifted his glass but did not drink. "I have considered the possibility that I've gone insane."
Legrand was now up, pacing the room. "God was with you that night, brother," he said, patting Jorski on the shoulder. "You lived to tell about it, over a glass of brandy. This Nosferatu, she was alone? You didn't see any other creature stirring about?"
"No, brother. In 68 years I have never seen a creature like this. Seeing two in one night would have been remarkable indeed.
Legrand laughed heartily. Quite so, my friend the vampire is a solitary predator.
You are familiar with these creatures, Legrand, replied an astonished Jorski. I used to consider their existence to be mere legend and no more.
Not legend, Legrand said. They exist, as you discovered at your own peril. The Nosferatu is an inhabiting demon, taking possession of the soul at the moment of death. The vampire will rise after the host has been dead for 3 days, mocking the resurrection of Christ. They are satanic, evil, a dark miracle, nest ce par.
The church knows about these creatures, asked Jorski with a hint of panic.
Of course it's a form of possession, demonic possession, yet the church is highly secretive in such matters, explained Legrand. It is quite common for a vampire to visit family. They seem to be drawn to familiar places, which makes them vulnerable. A former spouse or lover is almost certain to receive a visit. Perhaps the Lady Gravis would extend her invitation to the three of us. We have a professional interest in her nocturnal visitor.
I'm sure the lady would be comforted by your presence, Jorski said.
Have there been any other sightings of this Nosferatu? Kale asked, and Jorski's face drained of colour. A true witness to the supernatural was often jarred by an interview with the Malachi, who spoke of the paranormal with detachment. To Kale, Jorski's obvious discomfort lent authenticity to his account.
No, answered Jorski evenly, we haven't seen her since the night I just described to you. I've set a guard on Gravis Manor, hiring several local hunters with church funds. There are at least two at the estate after nightfall. Over the lady's objections, I insisted that Victor sit at the lady's bedside throughout the night, and I have been spending my nights at the manor as well. However, the men do not leave the estate after sundown. The surrounding forest has an evil reputation, even the bravest hunters shun that wood at night.
Excellent, Brother Jorski, Dennis said. To your credit, you risked your reputation to protect this woman.
Thank you, answered Jorski, but I believe the lady is still in danger. The local gypsies have begun to speak of a lady of the wood that haunts the forest. This dark spirit stalks their people, and in the last fortnight they have lost two of their own. The title they give this spirit is derivative of a local legend, Jorski added. The pagans who live in these parts gather at night for ceremonies in the forest, and worship a lord of the wood. By chance, hunters will occasionally discover the remnants of what appears to be a sacrificial grove, where these ceremonies take place. These are ancient practices, some of which predate Christianity. The Lord of the Wood is a powerful deity, to whom the pagans offer a periodic blood sacrifice to ensure fertility and wealth. But it's getting late, my brothers. I would be grateful if you would accompany me to the Gravis estate.
It was near dusk when they arrived at Gravis Manor. There they were received by the lady, who despite being a widow still covered her hair in a brown wimple. She dressed with simple elegance, her green kirtle cinched by a brown leather belt, from which hung a set of prayer beads.
Jorski introduced the Malachi, then added, Lady Gravis, these brothers are here to help us resolve this mystery.
I am most grateful, said the lady as she led them into the parlour. Kale guessed that she had once been a dancer, for she moved with fluid grace, her step almost a glissade as she gestured with a sweep of her hand. Please sit down, she said. She then offered a late dinner for her new guests, who politely declined.
Lady Gravis, may we offer our condolences on the loss of your daughter, Dennis said. Brother Jorski told us what happened. Can you describe, as best as you can, the events after the funeral?
Lady Gravis rocked in her chair, momentarily silent as she glanced at the window that opened into the garden. It was less than a week after the funeral, she said, her voice soft, almost a whisper, when I woke late one night to the sound of Eleanor's harp. She nodded to the corner where Kale sat. Behind him stood the instrument, half covered in a white linen sheet. I recognized her playing immediately, and my heart leaped with joy, and I was halfway down the staircase before I realized the impossibility and thought that I must be dreaming. But Eleanor sat right where that young man is sitting now. And when she turned, I screamed and ran back to my room, locking the door behind me.
Why did you scream? What exactly did you see? Dennis asked.
I saw Eleanor's ghost, Lady Gravis replied. She was pale, her eyes gleaming, yet lifeless, and I knew that she was dead. A few moments later, Stanna, my housemaid, rapped on my door to check on me. I was too horrified to let her in. Since no one had seen Eleanor, nor heard the music of the harp, I convinced myself that I had fallen into the thrall of a most vivid nightmare. But you cannot imagine my terror, Brother Dennis, when on the following night the harp rang out again. Only this time a rude hand flailed on the strings, the player's intent no more than a total corruption of music. Then all became quiet, until I heard a footfall on the stairs. From the hallway I heard Victor shout, and then there was a scream. I cowered in my room till dawn, then went to see Father Jorski. At this point, Lady Gravis hesitated, then added, Father stayed with me for the next 2 nights, and we both saw Eleanor in the garden. The lady looked to the window again, as faded light spilled into the parlour.
How long has Stanna been with you, my lady? Dennis asked. Stanna? Why nearly 40 years my mother hired her, and she came with me to this house when I married my husband.
And this man Victor?
Victor is Stana's son, born and raised in our household, answered Lady Gravis.
We would like to interview all of your servants, my lady, Le Grand said. Now if I can impose on you, please show us your bedroom.
Lady Gravis led them up the stairs, where on the landing stood a gold-framed looking glass, and Kale was stopped short by his own image. The double reality of reflective glass always amazed him, and as he lingered there Dennis brushed by, whispering,
Vanity, brother take care.
Legrand entered the master bedroom and removed several garlic wreaths that hung near the bed. Do you like the smell of garlic? Legrand asked. The lady sat on the edge of the bed and pinched her nose with comic flair. Legrand handed the wreaths to the housemaid. Take these down to the kitchen, please. It doesn't help, although a little garlic sauce over pheasant is always delightful.
What about the crosses, Le Grand? Jorski asked. Several were placed around the room, and a large crucifix hung near the lady's headboard. Le Grand moved across the chamber, his back to Jorski as he opened the windows that looked out over the garden. In the distance ran the wooded hills, tranquil in the orange dusk.
Perhaps we should excuse ourselves from the lady's presence, Le Grand said, before we discuss this any further.
If this pertains to my daughter, I want to hear what is said, replied the lady. Le Grand then turned and took her hands in his and sat with her on the bed.
My dear lady, Eleanor is dead, Le Grand said. You know that, don't you? Lady Gravis looked down and said nothing. Her soul is possessed, a body perverted by an evil agency, added Le Grand. We must find her body and destroy it. That is Eleanor's only hope of salvation. Without the body, the demon has no vessel to do harm. We will protect you and those around you, and do what is best for Eleanor. Do you trust me and my brothers?
The lady nodded, her lips trembling, and then she resisted no more, burying her face in Legrand's doublet, and wept with heaving sobs as Legrand held her.
In a just world, a mother would never have to bury her daughter, Le Grand said. Soon Eleanor will be at peace, and so will you. After Lady Gravis excused herself, Le Grand turned to Jorski. As you know from first-hand experience, a cross will not stop a Nosferatu. Remember, it was Victor's torch that saved you, not the cross. Don't be confused about what we're dealing with here. Think of a wolf, or better yet, a rabid lunatic. Most vampire lore is nonsense. The Nosferatu cannot disappear, nor fly, and hanging garlic is a pagan remedy. Unfortunately, crosses are just as useless. The simple facts are these: the Nosferatu must feed, so it hunts, and we are their prey.
I can take you to the mausoleum where Eleanor rests, Jorski said. The family crypt is less than a mile from here.
She's not there, Le Grand said, but let us go, just to be sure.
Le Grand, why don't you stay here with Lady Gravis, Dennis said. I want at least one Malachi with her at all times. Kale and I will go with Brother Jorski to the mausoleum.